Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Bethany Crowley. Bethany is the founder and clinical director at The Journey Therapy in Hawaii, where she leads a compassionate team who are dedicated to helping those struggling with eating disorders. With over 25 years of experience, Bethany has guided hundreds to lasting recovery through her unique integrative approach, teaching essential skills to conquer disordered eating and handle life's challenges. As a certified eating disorder specialist, EMDR practitioner, and biofeedback expert, she's not only a therapist but also a mentor, offering online training and supervision to fellow professionals. When she's not supporting individuals in recovery from an eating disorder, Bethany enjoys the island life with her family and three dogs. This week, we discuss the 9 foundational skills that Bethany explores in her book, An Integrative Approach to Treating Eating Disorders, and why all of them are key to recovery and how they prevent relapse.
Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Good. No, thank you so much for joining me. It is so lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Did you want to just introduce yourself for the listeners?
Sure. So I've worked in all levels of care, starting with the lowest level of care, which is outpatient, and then also partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, residential, and also inpatient, working with this population. So this has been my passion, my life's work, and I'm just really excited to be here today.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely amazing. 25 years.
Yes.
That is a long time to be in the industry. So yeah, it does definitely sound like it's your passion. And how did you first start working with people with eating disorders?
So I first started working with people with eating disorders when I was just out of graduate school. I was working in a psychiatric facility. And most of the patients that were there were more of the, you know, people that were more diagnosed with severely, you know, mentally, was basically described as severely mentally ill. And so here and there, we would have one or two patients that would come in that struggled with eating, maybe bulimia or like anorexia. But at the time, there wasn't any facility for them, a specialized facility for them. And so a lot of times they would come into the hospital with just the rest of the general population, psychiatric population. And so a lot of times they would have difficulty, of course, you know, just kind of being able to like be a part of that population or milieu. And so I really kind of started to kind of sit with them and kind of talk with them. And then I realized that this was a population that I was really interested in. And so my first job working in a specialized hospital was in California, and probably about like a year or so after I graduated from my graduate program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was it in particular that you found so interesting?
The thing that I found so interesting about working with people who struggle with eating is that they're just like me, you know, just like anyone else. It's just like, you would never know that they had a problem with food or body image. And they were the smartest people I've known, just the brilliant, the most sensitive, most sweetest, most like, just so many strengths, but they couldn't see it. And I could. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I think kind of I was drawn to, really kind of wanting to understand, like, why do you not see yourself the way I see you? Mm-hmm. And so that started the journey. And I just really, just women's issues has always been a passion of mine. And getting just like to know each person that I've worked with, just understanding, you know, just where they're coming from and just what they're struggling with, just has been my passion.
Yeah. I mean, and that sounds so lovely. And the fact that you kind of had that connection to them to kind of, you know, really want to learn more and understand what was going on for them. From my experience of working within facilities and stuff, sometimes when professionals are working with people with eating disorders, it can almost become they can almost just see the illness rather than actually seeing that there is a human behind that. And I think sometimes that can make it quite difficult because you're then trying to treat the disorder rather than actually trying to treat that person. And it's so lovely that you were, you know, saying how you were the smartest and the sweetest and all those things that they couldn't see that you could see. That's such a nice perspective to have of the clients that you are working with.
Totally. And I love that you said what you just said, because that kind of is the whole point of my book. And it's like, because I, for me, when I work with someone, I never look at them as a disorder or like just their symptoms. I really look at getting to know the person, and everyone's so unique. And everyone yes. has just a unique story. And that's kind of how I look at it when I meet someone, is that I want to get to know their story and get to know who they are and what, why they're doing what they're doing. And then understand them from their perspective. And really, once I understand someone from their perspective, it all makes sense. And that's when I can really work with them and help guide them through, and also be able to kind of really help them recover from their eating disorder. Because then I can see them for where they're at and how they're seeing the world and their life in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's such a lovely way of putting it. And from my own personal experience of kind of the past year of my recovery, it has really been about trying to understand me as a person and the needs that I didn't feel were being met, that the eating disorder was meeting and things like that. But I really want to talk to you about your book that you just mentioned. So I guess I'm really interested to know what kind of inspired you to write the book.
Okay. So when I first started in this field 25 years ago, I was just out of school and I started working in a specialized hospital. And I was really wanting to learn just like everything I could about the disorder. And so I went to the bookstore, I went online, and I honestly couldn't find anything. It was really difficult for me to find a lot of resources back then. You know, there were some, but I felt like a lot of the resources were similar. And a lot of it, back then it did help me by giving me some information, but it didn't really say, how would you actually work with this person? You know, it was kind of like, okay, this person, it was more the symptom. The books, a lot of the books were, this is what they're doing. This is what they're doing. They're purging their, you know, their whatever behaviors, you know. And that was it. It wasn't like, okay, why are they doing this? It was, if there was information about that, it was really generalized. It was sort of like family issues, sort of more like a blanket statement, you know, like this person's dealing with, you know, some family issues, or this person has body image issues, or this person needs to be in control, just very general. And so I was looking for at the time a book that would help me understand it better. You know, understand the person better, but there was nothing out there that any kind of book like that. And then I also wanted a book that actually showed me how I could work with someone, like maybe actually have real exercises to say, like, you know, let's sit down and let's work through this, whatever it is that you're talking about, that you're struggling with. Like if you're having a hard time eating, I wanted an exercise for me to help the person that was having a hard time eating, not just you need to eat or not just get over, you know, like it's okay. It's just about accepting your body. So that's not going to happen. I wanted an exercise before that, like the exercise to kind of get them there. And then it was a struggle to find anything like that. And so through my experience, I started to sort of develop it on my own. You know, as I was working with people, I just kind of started to notice certain patterns that kept coming up. You know, being in this field for so long and working with thousands of people that have struggled with their eating disorder, you tend to start to hear similar stories, although it's very different because it's different experience for everyone. There are key themes that stuck out to me, and I started to write those key themes down. And so once I started to write those key themes down, just through the years of working with people, I started to notice that a lot of the people that I was working with were recovering from their eating disorder. So I started to look at what were the things that I was doing that was actually really helping them. And so I kind of started keeping sort of a journal about all of those things. And then, you know, I think it was probably into my 7th year or 8th year of working with people. I, at that point, already wanted to write a book. But then, you know, life happens. I had a child, had a family, you know, things like that. So I paused for a moment here and there. And then when I got back on, I did some research. And what I found was a lot of the research that was out there reflected what I found in my own experience. But it was sort of information that no one used yet, as far as like putting it together, you know, in a practical sort of book, where if you were to give it to a newly starting, you know, newly therapist who's just starting out, they could actually read it and actually understand more than maybe they did just, you know, just by reading any other book. And so anyway, that was what inspired me to write it, because I really felt like some things were missing, and it drove me sort of a little bit crazy when people ask me that, you know, ask me, you treat eating disorders. And then they have little jokes about food, or they have a little jokes about body image. That would kind of bug me a lot. And so I really made it my mission to write a book to really just lay out there very clear. It's not about food. It's not about body image. That's the stuff that's on the surface. That's the stuff that we focus on. But it's not about that. It's way deeper. And there's a purpose and there's a function. If it were, and I write this in the book, if it were about that, the population that struggles with this, they know everything about nutrition. They know everything about, you know, all of that. It's not about that. It's about something much deeper. And it's really about being able to learn about themselves and also understand why they're feeling the way they are about certain things. So I found that in this whole research and just doing my work, and the thing that I connect most with my clients with is that, and the ones that do well, that succeed, and recover from their eating disorder, is that when you struggle with an eating disorder, I feel like when things make sense for the client, as far as what I'm saying, when things make sense in their life, they don't need their eating disorder anymore. Mm-hmm. So it could be something where it's like something might be undiagnosed, or it might be something that was going on in their family, or it might be something that was happening that they don't have the words for yet, but they feel it. It feels unsettling. They just don't have the words to articulate what it is yet. But once they get the clarity and they understand how it all fits, that's when they recover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so unbelievably powerful, everything that you've just said. And I just was sat here like nodding along, because I think it's something that, you know, people in general population, sometimes even clinicians, don't get. Right. Is that an eating disorder, like you said, on the surface level, maybe, you know, Right. It's about food and body, Right. But it's so much more than that. And I think so often people just try and treat the food and body element, and that's, I think, where you see a lot of people sort of coming in and out of different eating disorders, different behaviors, because the fundamental issue at the root, you know, that root cause isn't being dealt with. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting what you were saying there about kind of, you know, once somebody realizes who they are, or that root cause down there, that's when they go on to recover. And I mean, I've been harping on about this for the past few episodes on the podcast, but I recently got diagnosed with ADHD, and for me that was the light that I needed to be like, oh my god, it makes sense now. Yes. Like I've learned so much about myself in such a short period of time But I get it now.
Yes.
And it's meant that I've been able to be like, wait, I don't need to use those behaviors anymore to navigate or right. to communicate
right.
because I can do that for myself.
Yes.
Now. So that, you know, when you said that, I was like, uh-huh, yep. No, I totally, totally understand. And when you were talking about kind of the journal that you kept and stuff, I was really interested to hear from you about what those themes were okay. in terms of what kind of brought on the eating disorder or why people used it okay. From what you looked into.
Yeah, so thank you for that question, because that's actually what the whole book's about. The entire book is around everything that I learned in the 25 years, pretty much, of, you know, like the themes that I found. And so, for example, so there's this research that shows outcomes that they say that if these people who struggle with eating issues are able to address and take care of, are less likely to relapse. And things like autonomy, things like being able to accept your body image, things like being able to communicate effectively, you know, setting your boundaries, being able to tolerate distress, you know, those kinds of different things. So those are some of the research, what the research showed. And what I found was that, aligned with the research, that my clients would struggle with similar things. And so, for example, I'm going to kind of go through the things that, and that was the theme, and that's mm-hmm. kind of how I set it up in the book. But when someone first comes in struggling with an eating issue, the first thing that they say is, I'm having a hard time eating. That's their cause. They're coming in, and whether it be a family member or someone else, they've said to them, you know, like, you have a problem because whether you're not eating or you're eating too much or whatever it is, there's an issue with food. So they're coming in for that. So that's one thing. And the second thing, they might be coming in with some may have it, some may struggle less with it, some more. And it might be body image, dissatisfaction, where it's like, okay, I wish I looked better. I wish I looked like this person, or, you know, just like what's shown in the media, or, you know, they just want to look like something that they're not satisfied with how they look. And so that might be another issue they're coming in with. So that's like the obvious. So that's the thing that we're going to be working on first. So that the theme that we notice is that they're having some kind of struggle with eating and or understanding what they're feeling in their body. So the first thing that I did was I did name that first skill, mind-body connection. And what the mind-body connection means is that when someone first comes in with an eating issue, they have a hard time recognizing when they're physically hungry or when they're physically full. So they have a difficult time doing that. They also have a difficult time knowing what they're feeling emotionally. So like it might be, I feel sad, or but I'm really actually angry, or I'm feeling I'm okay with it, but they're really not. You know, like there's lots of feelings that feel conflicting. And so a lot of times they're having a hard time articulating what it is that they're feeling. And so the mind-body connection is a big piece, where that's like the first thing I start with when I work with someone. It's just helping them understand it. Because if you imagine someone coming in that has a hard time recognizing what they're sensing in their body, that's going to cause a lot of fear. Because mm-hmm. it causes a lot of fear and anxiety, because there's that fear of, if I start eating, I might not know when to stop. If I don't eat, I feel like I can't eat because I'm not really hungry, because they're not sensing their cues. And so that piece is so important in order for us to like even do the work, to start the work. So that's the first piece I have to address, because that's an issue that we have to look at. So that's the first piece. The second foundational skill is really what the food's about. So the first one is about mind-body connection, kind of really understanding what your body's feeling in the moment. So the second foundational skill is really, really about differentiating the two. So if you're physically hungry, you're honoring your body by eating food, and you're stopping when you're physically full. But then say you're actually physically hungry, but you're not allowing yourself to eat. If when that happens, it means there's a meaning behind that. So foundational skill number two is, what do those behaviors mean? So if I'm actually hungry, but I'm not allowing myself to eat, then there's a function for that. So that's not really listening to your body. Same thing as if you are not hungry and you feel like your body's physically full, but you continue to eat, that's emotional hunger. So we look at foundational skill number two as we're going to decode what that means. And so then that's foundational skill number two. So the first one is mind body connection. Second one is decoding the behaviors. If we're not honoring what our body needs, there's meaning behind that. And so we have to take a look at that. Because a lot of times the meaning, whatever it is that we're doing, like you said earlier, we might be for restricting our food, not eating. It might be a way of communication. It might be our way of communicating, this is too much. I can't deal with this right now. There's a lot of feelings that are coming up. I don't have the words to say it. So that's what the foundational skill number two is. It's how do we decode that? And it's different for everyone. And so that's the reason I was saying that when I get to know someone, I just have a conversation with them and they're telling me their story and what they're going through. And I can make the mental map of what's happening and how their eating disorder is showing up just by having a conversation about their day. So these are the factors that make treating an eating disorder difficult or complex, because there's so many different variables that can feed into why someone's using their eating disorder. It's not just food and body image. So a contributing factor is thoughts. So a lot of times, you know, for example, if I'm listening to my body and I'm taking a bite of food, I might have a loud thought that says, don't eat that, because if you eat that, some X, Y, and Z is going to happen. Or, you know, whatever is going to happen. But these are the thoughts that someone who has eating disorder struggles with. And, or if they do eat it, there's lots of feelings that come through that says, you shouldn't have done that. Now you're, X, Y, Z, whatever. Just those kinds of thoughts. Critical, negative thoughts. In the book, I separate them. I talk about the eating disorder thoughts. I talk about our critical voice thoughts. I talk about just various different kinds of thoughts that people struggle with. So that's one that we have to learn, is how do we recognize those thoughts when they come up? How do we deal with those thoughts? How do we quiet those thoughts? Because what happens is my clients will tell me, Beth, I am working on foundational skill number one, and I'm working on foundational skill number two, and I know what it's about. But then when I eat, I hear this nagging voice that says, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or I went over too much, or they start having these punishing thoughts. And so then I teach them to acknowledge those thoughts, to kind of recognize when it's coming. And then that's what the book has. It's like concrete exercises on how to do that. And that was what I was saying, is that when I was looking for a book like that, it's like, okay, what do we do with that? Okay, so it's known that a client might be struggling with negative thoughts, but what do you do with it? And so a lot of the books in the past would say, well, you have them be mindful. How do you do that? So it needed to be more practical. It needed to be, because a lot of times when you say to your client, let's practice mindfulness, they're like, what is that? I have no idea what mindfulness is. But if I say to them, hey, let's sit down together, and all I want you to do is I want you to focus on the butterfly just for 5 minutes. Let's just focus on the butterfly. And then when they can go through those exercises, and then I say, now can you describe what you saw? And then they say, well, I saw a butterfly. I saw the wings fluttering. I saw the antennas moving. And then in the moment I would say, when you were noticing that, what else did you notice? Oh, nothing. They would say nothing. That's mindfulness. So that's kind of how I teach them, by doing these little exercises that they can do at home. And once they start doing it, I also have other exercises and just sort of like information in there in the book where it kind of tells them like, hey, I know it's really hard that you're doing this. It's kind of like cheering them on, cheering, you know, like having the therapist learn to cheer the clients on. Because when clients get that reinforcement that they're on the right track, then they feel more confident that, hey, you know what? I am doing this. Like each step I'm doing, it makes me feel good. And now I have a plan in my head. So the thing that scares people, you know, like people who are struggling with eating issues too, is ambiguity of things. When things feel ambiguous, when it feels like, okay, I don't know if this is right. I think it might be. It's a trigger because they have no idea, like if they're on the right track or not. So if the therapist is able to say, you're doing it great, just the way you are, because this is where you need to be, they feel confident, like, okay, I can keep doing this. And then they start having that self-talk, like, I'm doing it. So they start to internalize the therapist's voice. And that's the whole goal of this book. It's really, I'm trying to teach the client to become their own therapist so that they have all of these tools and they know what to do with it at all times. So the next thing after the negative thoughts is a big one, because sometimes my clients would practice the dealing with negative thoughts. And then they'll say something like, you know, I know that I'm not supposed to be thinking this thing about, you know, this really negative thing, like that I'm a failure, for example. They might say, the thought is, I'm a failure. When I eat, I feel like a failure. So I might say to them, okay, now we have to move to the next, we have to move on to the next foundational skill, which is self-compassion and self-perception. And also, like, just learning about themselves in that way. So that's the fourth foundational skill. Where what happens in that skill is you're learning about where. Because a lot of times, the reason why they're stuck with these negative thoughts is because it feels real. Like, I'm a failure feels real. So if I ask them, what makes you feel like you're a failure? They'll say, I ate food, because that's the surface. But if I were to say to them, and I were to do exercises with them, I'm able to help them connect back to the first time they did feel like they were a failure. Those are the memories that have been stored in their mind, which when they're doing something else that they feel like they're not doing well at, it triggers those memories from the past, and it triggers that where it feels like I'm a failure again presently. And so once we work through those things, they're able to recognize that. We call them schemas. Like, these are schemas. These are old stories. These are old experiences that maybe when they experienced it at the time, they felt like a failure in that moment. And so if they felt like a failure in that moment, then when it's a trigger, because it reminds them of whatever it is that they're doing now, it brings them back to that time. And so those are some exercises that we help work through. But once the client gets that awareness, when they have that awareness, they're able to catch it every time, because I teach them and I give them an exercise to practice by saying, okay, when you feel this feeling, what does this remind you of? Where, you know, they have a couple of questions that they ask themselves, and they're able to pinpoint exactly the time they felt that way. And when they do, they're able to recognize, okay, that was a time a long time ago. We can work through that piece in therapy. And then they can also acknowledge that it's not happening right now, that that's not really what's happening, although it feels like it's happening right now. So that awareness is powerful. And so that's what I was saying, that when clients understand, like, what's going on, it just, everything just falls into place, because it just feels like it's not so out of control anymore. It feels like, okay, this makes sense to me. So they feel more stable.
I mean, I have so many things as you're talking that I want to say, but I think the fundamental thing that is, like, really feels quite poignant for me is, whilst going through an eating disorder and recovery is, I'd argue, one of the hardest things that I've ever had to do in my life. You know, really, really difficult. But I think the difficulty comes because you have to work so hard on understanding yourself. And when you are at war with yourself, with your brain, with your body, it's really difficult to then actually have to sit with yourself and learn so much about yourself. And one thing that you said when you were talking about foundation skill number one, the mind-body connection, what really came up for me was actually starting to trust yourself, you know, trusting that you are feeling this emotion and that is okay, giving yourself compassion for that, or you're hungry right now and that's okay. Your body needs that fuel. And whilst that's all so incredibly difficult and painful, and I think that one thing I have been really grateful for is the awareness I have about myself now. Like, when I look at other people in society or some friends, you know, I'm really lucky to be in a group of very self-aware people that have really taken time to learn about themselves. But I feel that I know myself so well. And it's like you were saying there, you know, oh, I'm struggling with foundational skill number five today or whatever. Like, a lot of people, even, you know, could be 90, they haven't taken that time to really get to know themselves and learn themselves. But I feel lucky in the weirdest kind of way that this has put me in a position where I had no choice but had to kind of unpick everything about myself and really give myself that space and time to learn more about me in order to recover.
Sure. And so, and when you mentioned earlier too, you said the foundation of skill number one, not knowing like what you're feeling and trusting your body, is absolutely true. Like that's what my foundation of skill number one is. And then you had to learn that you had to give yourself self-compassion along with that. And so know that when I write about the 9 foundational skills, I put them in an order where I feel like it shows up for clients, but when they're recovering, it's simultaneous. This foundational skill is happening at the same time as this one. And so we need to pull the compassion skill at the same time we're working on foundational skill number one. So like it's all of these different ones, and they show up differently for everyone. But these are the main skills that we need, and you learn to use them all at once, because that's how complex eating disorders are. And that's why it's like, to me, it's like, and so it is. It's like, that's what my clients tell me all the time, is that this is the hardest thing that they ever had to overcome, you know? And it's like, but once they do go through it and they gain that awareness, it's like, you know, it's like the biggest gift that they have, that they know so much about themselves.
I think also, as you were just saying that as well, is it's all a process. And I think one other thing for me that I've learned is like, when I was deep in the depths of the eating disorder, there was no room for error. Like if I did something wrong, that critical voice was absolutely there telling me I'd done everything wrong. Like I was a really bad person for that. But through recovery, you know, some days, I'm really self-aware now and I know a lot more about myself, but sometimes I get it wrong. And it's having that compassion to know that I got it wrong. Like some days I might have thought I needed a bit more food and actually I didn't, or I might have tuned into my emotions a little bit wrong. But also with that, I think as well, with the critical thoughts that you mentioned, one thing I found really interesting was it's not about getting rid of that. And I actually was talking to someone else about this the other day, and that your critical voice, when you're in the depth of an eating disorder, is awful, because every single thing you do, even if it's perfect, is wrong. But actually having a critical voice, I thought that I needed to get rid of that. Actually, it just needed turning down a little bit. You know, I do actually quite like having that because it motivates me. It gets me up in the morning. It makes me determined, dedicated. It keeps my passions alive because I've got something that is keeping me going. But it's about being able to turn it down a little bit and increase that compassion that you also mentioned.
Yes. And also recognizing sometimes that there is a function for our critical voice. And the critical voice might be, you know, it's like, maybe I'm not feeling super safe right now. Maybe that critical voice is saying, hey, you know, let's do this, so that it's a protection in a way. And then so we can acknowledge that the voice is there, like we can acknowledge it, okay, but if it's too loud or it's starting to affect us in that way, we can even say, I got this. And so you have this dialogue with yourself and you say, you know what, I know you're the voice, to talk to the voice. And I know that you have my back, but I'm okay. Like I can do this.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that actually, because last week I've been asked for a few months to write a letter to my eating disorder by my therapist, and I just haven't felt in a place to do it. And I did it last week. And the overarching message of the letter was, thank you so much for coming when I didn't feel safe enough to look after myself or didn't feel that I had people around me that I could lean into. Thank you so much for being there. But I'm okay now. And now I've gone through this journey, I've got myself, and that's what I didn't have before. So, you know, I can actually say, I can park you. But I also, in the letter, I wrote about, I don't want to say goodbye, because I'm actually, you know, I don't want the eating disorder to stay necessarily. But if there's a sign that something's not quite going right in life, or I'm not quite looking after myself right, it's the eating disorder is almost a sign of like, okay, things, maybe you need to take a little bit more time to think about things, or you need to give a bit more compassion if I start to lean into those behaviors. So I think it's all just, like you said, it's a massive piece, isn't it, of really becoming more self-aware and learning kind of your needs and, yes. and trusting yourself.
Yes. I actually say that to my clients all the time. I say, you know, when you struggle with an eating disorder and you're in recovery, your eating disorder voice becomes almost your superpower in a way that it quiets down. But you notice once you start to notice the voice coming back, then you have to ask yourself, hey, I'm not taking yeah. care of myself right now. And it's a signal to say like, okay, mm-hmm. what am I needing? What am I afraid of right now that I'm not really wanting to look at? And so it's sort of like a layer to say like, hey, let's look at this so that we don't miss something. So if we can look at it in that way, so it doesn't need to take over, but we can just understand that there's a function for it. And that function, mm-hmm. whenever we start to hear things like we start to get a little afraid of food or we start to think about more body image or we start to compare our bodies, then we have to ask ourselves, hey, what's going on that feels uncomfortable for right now? What am I afraid of? Okay, so number five is exploring body neutrality and acceptance. So what that means is we all know it's obvious that with the media and all of that, that eating, you know, body image with society and how society views body image is a certain way. And I think there's more awareness now, you know, about how that affects people. And I think that there's more sensitivity around it at this point. I think that it's really important, though, that we also look at, aside from just what the, you know, like society says about our bodies and things like that, but there's actually a lot of information about what our body represents. And so that's kind of what I talk about in chapter five is like what our body represents. So a lot of times what I found is that, you know, a lot of clients that I see will say something like, you know, I'm really uncomfortable in my body. I just don't like the way I look. And when I ask them, you know, like, tell me more about that, a lot of times they'll say something like, you know, it's just the way, you know, I don't like that my hips are big, or I don't like that something else, you know, just whatever it is that they just don't like. And then when I ask them, you know, what is that about? Like, tell me more. It really comes down to a lot of times it's just about self-love, really, when it comes down to it. Because if the questions that I pose might be something like, tell me more about that, you know, body part that you don't like, what's the worst thing about it for you? Like if your body looks a certain way, might be something like, well, I'll be ugly. Or, and so what will happen if you're ugly? Well, then I just feel like I'm not going to be loved or accepted or be part of something or have that life I really wanted, you know? So the body just really becomes a representation of whatever it is, of their fear of something. And so a lot of times, because, and I'll ask my clients this, because a lot of times they'll have evidence in their mind. They'll say something like, I'm X amount of weight. And society says that's unacceptable. Maybe that's what they'll say. And so if a therapist is treating them, a therapist might say, oh, okay, because I've heard, you know, like other clients have told me this before, where a therapist might say, okay, you might want to lose X amount of weight because your body is on the bigger side or whatever it is. And so then they get sort of validated for that, you know, and it's like, okay, let's focus on the weight and let's just lose the weight. So my thing is, it's not about losing weight. It's more about, what does that mean? Because I might say to my client yesterday, or tell me a time, like tell me a recent time when you actually felt really good, like just had a good day and you didn't really think about your body. And they might say something like, oh, last week, I had a really great time with my family. You know, they were, you know, whatever. We were spending time together and I didn't really think anything about my body image that day. So I'm like, okay, but what? So I said, so I might ask them a question like, what do you think it is that last week you were the exact same size that you are today? And why is it that you think that last week it didn't bother you so much in your body and today it does? And they can't come up with the answer. And then they say, well, it's because I'm just uncomfortable today. I can feel it. My clothes feel tighter. And it really has to do, and I let them know, I say, well, it's because today it sounds like you're having a hard time because you're kind of feeling a little bit of anxiety, their words, maybe feeling a little anxiety about hanging out with some friends. And so that's a trigger. And so it's like your emotion, the mood, it's what you're feeling triggers whether or not you're going to be more satisfied or less satisfied with your body. So in that moment when last week or when you were with your family, that didn't even cross your mind, you felt comfortable. And so it didn't bother you. But then today it does. So that's kind of what I really work with them on. And once they get it, they understand it. That just like food represents something, body image represents something as well. And so like there are times where, you know, I can't tell you how many times where clients will tell me like, I just don't fit in this. I feel so uncomfortable. But when I really get to it and find out what's going on, it's because they're uncomfortable about something else that's happening. Mm-hmm. And their fear is that they're not going to be accepted or not going to be loved or whatever. They're going on a date and that person's not going to accept them. They're going to have rejection. And so they're grounding all of those feelings in their bodies where it's like, okay, this is evidence. This is why I'm not lovable, because this is not acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so interesting when you put it that way. And I think it's how you said, you know, with the food and the body, is that a lot of the kind of symptoms that you have, you almost reflect onto food and body, because that's something that you can, it's something tangible. Yes. It's something that you feel like Yes. You can explain and make sense. Yes. But when it's kind of a deeper emotion than that, like anxiety about a certain situation, it can feel like that's too yes. hard to access, or you yes. don't really want to think about that. So it's just like, no, I'll focus yes. on this thing that is really easy yes. to suggest, or, yes. you know, that I've yes. got grasps on yes. rather than the underlying thing.
Yeah. And so that's the thing with the ambiguity. People who struggle with eating issues have a hard time with those feelings. This is ambiguous. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what that's about. But if I know it's my body, then I can buy bigger clothes, buy smaller clothes, try to lose some weight, try to like do something about it so that I have a plan. If it's a feeling, it's like, what do I do with this feeling?
Yeah. 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 And also I think, you know, with weight, it's not always the case, but often it, you know, with your food and things like that, it's something you can control. You feel like you can control your yes. intake, or, yes. you know, if you reduce what you're eating, then you can lose weight totally. And you have control over that. Whereas your emotions, when you don't understand them or have grasps over them, it can feel like you have no control, and you like, oh no, I don't want to feel that. And I think that's what kind of suppressing food also can do. I know it did for me. It just kind of numbed everything. Yeah. I didn't really feel emotions because there wasn't that much energy right. to feel yes. a broad span of emotions yes. anyway.
Exactly. That's exactly the function. Because you don't have the energy. You're kind of in this place where you're not eating. So then you're not connected to your body, so that you're not even yeah. aware that those feelings are
yeah.
there.
Yeah, exactly. Which at the time I think can feel good. But then I've noticed now, okay, yeah, I do feel emotions, and maybe I'm feeling sadness and stuff, but oh my God, I'm feeling happiness and joy and excitement and love and connection. And you know, you have to have the balance.
Yes.
That's life, isn't yes. it? You have the highs and lows. Mm-hmm. But it's so much better like that than to not feel yes. anything at all.
Totally. Yeah. But it feelings can feel a lot, like you said earlier, just out of control. So mm-hmm. even if it's happy feelings, a lot of times my clients will say, like, that's scary to feel happy. Because sometimes it's scary because it's like, if I feel happy, then what if it stops? It's just like it's the same similar feeling as if I eat, what if I can't stop? You know, it just feels like I don't have any control. And which leads us to the next skill. So a lot of times what happens is when you're feeling all these feelings, like you mentioned, it's a way to cope because it helps you not feel at all. But it also helps you like really focus on the body, because when you have these feelings that are uncomfortable, sometimes the clients are aware. They're totally aware of where these feelings are coming from because they're doing the work now. And they realize, oh, it's coming from, maybe it's a relationship. Maybe it's someone that I've been at work. Maybe I'm having relationship or like interpersonal problems with someone, and I'm really afraid to say how I feel. And so therefore I know like it's this dynamic that I have at work or this dynamic at home, but I'm not sure how to deal with it. And so it might be easier for me to use food behaviors to not feel it than address it with this person. So that's the next one. So then that was the next coping are foundational skill, which is foundational skill number six, which is understanding myself in relation to others. And so that's a really important one because triggers a lot. A lot of times what happens is when someone is struggling with an eating disorder, they get into a place where they isolate. You know, it's like, I don't want anyone around. There's that anxiety about seeing people. And so like, it could be, I don't want to eat in front of people. I don't want to do anything because I'm afraid someone's going to judge me, or I don't want someone to ask me about food, or see my body, or just, so there's a lot of isolation. And so it's important that we are able to understand ourselves so that we can deal with the triggers and have connection with other people. And that's a huge piece, because eating disorders, when you're isolated, progressively gets worse, because the eating disorder thoughts get louder and louder and louder. But when you start to connect with others, the voice gets softer, quieter, and quieter. And so that's why it's so important to do that. And so understanding yourself in relation to others is really about understanding how you are with other people. How do you communicate with other people? How do you, just even caregivers, because a lot of times with the eating disorder, so this goes into a little bit more depth, with eating disorders, maybe we learn to communicate in a way that's not really effective. Maybe we learned it at a very young age, and so we haven't learned how to communicate in a way that is effective. And so we use behaviors to communicate. So we can stop eating, and that might be a way to restrict our voice, maybe not say what we're truly feeling. And it can also show our anger if we're upset with someone and we know that, you know, they worry about us if we're not eating. And so therefore it might be something where it's like, okay, I'm not going to eat at this point. But it's not even a conscious thing where you're saying, I'm not going to eat. Sometimes it is, but other times it's not. Other times it's just like, maybe you lose your appetite. Maybe it feels like I was able to eat a little while ago, but the situation that happened, just, I don't feel a hunger cue anymore. It's gone. Mm-hmm. And that, because it's so, it's whatever that interaction was bothered you so much that it made your body heavy in that moment. And it feels like I can't take anything in.
Yeah, I think the understanding self with others is, it's been like, it's such a key part of recovery. And I always say, you know, the one thing that you can control is how you respond to a situation. You cannot control how anybody else responds, how anybody else eats, how anybody else. And, you know, I think for so long, I went through a phase of being like, everyone needs to be careful about what they say about food around me.
Yes.
And then I realized, oh, I can do that to a point, but there's some people that I can't, like, you know, I warn you, I shouldn't be. But also, if you go into a random shop, you can't control what people are going to say. You'll meet new people, you can't control work colleagues, you can't control what they're going to say. And it's about being able to understand that you are your own unique person with your own needs, and they're their own unique person. And even if they are also struggling with an eating disorder, that doesn't mean that that's, I guess, an excuse for you to then play with those behaviors. Yes. And I think, similarly to the control aspect around like being able to control food and body as a way of navigating it, I think with comments that other people said, I always found that my eating sort of really liked that, because it like you said, it tries to isolate you.
Right.
And so if somebody said something that I found triggering, the eating sort of would be like, they said that to upset you. They're a horrible person. They're trying to get to you. They're trying to make you feel bad. And so it then isolated me from those people. And then it would isolate me from situations where I thought maybe comments would come up as well.
Right.
And, you know, you then get to a point, like you said, where it's kind of just you and the eating disorder existing together. But then I have definitely noticed, the more I step away from my eating disorder and the more that I engage with real human beings and connect with real human beings, the eating disorder has quietened. I mean, at the start, it was just got louder, because it was like, no, you're not having freedom, I'm keeping you. But as I kept pushing, it's now like there's actual real people that fill my brain and fill my time, so the eating disorder has reduced and there's not as much space for it now.
Totally, exactly. And also, like you just said, it's like you are able to recognize, like even with what you just said, it's like you're recognizing all of the other foundational skills in there, like number three, quieting your negative thought, like you're able to recognize that, and you're able to recognize that you're doing a great job with your recovery. Like that's great, where you're like, oh, I'm able to know that this is trying to isolate me. The thoughts are trying to isolate me because that's how I'm going to get healthy. And your healthy voice is so strong, you know, where it's like you're able to acknowledge that and you have so much consciousness. So yeah, that's exactly what it is. Good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And then, so with that, like number six, understanding myself in relation to others. I just want to say that that's probably when my clients are recovering and I can see that they're actually really progressing along. Number six comes up a lot because when someone is in their eating disorder, a lot of times they're not in relationship. They are, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with all of this. But once they start getting better and they, as far as like feeling better, they are stepping out and wanting to like date more and all that. And that's when number six really shows up. It starts to really show up because they're like, everything comes back. Like even their body image will come back up again, or then they'll start noticing like childhood, like feel abandonment or rejection or like all of those things that feel insecure, you know, like maybe I'm not good enough, maybe I'm not lovable, all of those things that come up from foundational skill number four. So like all of that is in foundational skill number six. But when they're able to work with that number six and they realize, well, you know what? They have the awareness about all the other foundational skills that lead them up to number six. Then they're able to practice the skills to actually, you know, to kind of to have that self-talk and then also speak with their loved ones or the people that they're in relationship with to communicate in a more effective way. And once they're able to do that, it's not so scary for them because that's also correcting their experience as they're doing that. So each time they do that, they feel like, okay, you know what? I can do this. This is okay. Mm-hmm. Relationships aren't as scary as I thought it was because now I have the tools to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I found that particularly for myself, the past sort of 18 months to a year has been really hard on my relationship. And over the past 6 months, it's really become my focus to make sure that my relationship doesn't suffer. And, you know, my partner has said it's like having the Hannah that he fell in love with back, because I've started to be able to communicate, be able to be present, be able to find enjoyment in things rather than normally, you know, when I was really ill, it was like I just wanted to be on my own all the time. I didn't want to go out for dinner. I didn't want to eat with him. I didn't want to cook with him, nothing. But all of those elements that just build wall after wall after wall between you. Even my friends, you know, it sounds silly, but I didn't think about the impact on my friends. And this weekend I went to a festival and so many people said, you are a completely different person now. Like you've got your sparkle back. And I was like, God, I didn't even know that I was acting differently. But it's so nice to be able to kind of reestablish those connections. And I think equally, you know, another thing that springs to my mind when we go through these stages is each one that you do, it gives you that motivation to go forward even more, because you start to see the beauty of recovery.
Exactly. And you're like,
oh, no,
yes,
this is so much better.
Yes, totally. Yeah, exactly. Everything with what you just said. And just even with what you shared with your friends, noticing, you know, like that life is back, you know, like you have it in your eyes and it's sparkling and you're like, back to yourself. It's like, it's the best feeling, you know, and seeing that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So number six after six, you know, like when you're dealing with a lot of even family members with understanding yourself or myself in relation to others, the next foundational skill is coping with emotional triggers and building resilience. So what comes from our relationships is the emotional triggers that happens, you know, and that we kind of talked about that, where we start to feel like, okay, maybe you just start dating and your partner said, hey, I'm going to give you a call, and they didn't. It's like, okay, that's a trigger, emotional trigger, because it's like all of these thoughts can kind of go through your mind, like, okay, is this person not interested anymore? Did I say something that was like not very smart? Am I, you know, it's going to bring up all of the insecurities, like not being lovable, you know, not being enough, and those things like that. So that can trigger a lot. And so another foundational skill, coping with emotional triggers and building resilience is a big one, because a lot of times when we're feeling those intense feelings, those intense emotions, it will lead someone to go use a behavior because it's like, I just want to turn it off. Like, I don't want to feel this anymore. And they don't, a lot of times, our clients newly in recovery have a hard time sitting with those emotions because it feels intense and it feels like it's never going to end. And so in the book, I do talk about like different exercises on how to deal with that, you know, and one exercise I give clients is just even just checking in with yourself, you know, and just kind of like, hey, what happened? Bring it. So a lot of what happens with emotions is we get swept away with our emotions because it feels really uncomfortable. But if we can like stop for a moment and really think about, where's this feeling coming from? What triggered it? You know, when you can really understand what happened, then you can kind of look at, okay, well, is that something that I really need? Like, you know, like you can kind of go into something else as far as like, there's other different kinds of therapies that you can look at. But a lot of it is going to be practicing sitting with that emotion or that feeling, and then also naming it. It's like, okay, I'm feeling sadness right now. And it's like, and then that self-compassion piece comes in again. It's like, you know what? It's okay to feel sad. You know, it's like, that was a sad moment, you know, and just kind of acknowledging that it's there and it's okay. So a lot of times, because we look at emotions that like it's negative, it feels like, okay, when I'm feeling it, I shouldn't be feeling this thing. It needs to, you know, I need to push it away. And so the more we push it away, the more we avoid it, the harder it gets. So when we start sitting with it and practicing working through it, it gets, it decreases. It's not as severe as far as the intensity of the emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think with that as well, I mean, especially in my experience, I've always used the eating disorder to navigate those difficult situations or those difficult emotions. And then all of a sudden you're like, right, I'm not supposed to do that anymore. So how do I deal with this emotion now? And it's so uncomfortable to sit with those emotions. I remember I always used to say, I can only feel happy or sad. And I hate like the middle. Like I just, I couldn't stand it. It was so uncomfortable. It was so the boredom of it, the mundaneness. And so I used to push myself into ecstatically happy, or I'd push myself into a really dark place. But it's now realizing I actually, because I have some ADHD coaching, and in that they got this emotion wheel up, and there was like six emotions in the middle that then split into like five emotions each, that then split into like two emotions each. And it was like, oh my God, like I didn't realize that there was such a wide variety of emotions. But actually being able to sit with yourself and understand what emotion you're feeling and why you're feeling that, and give yourself compassion that it's okay to be feeling that, and you know, how are you going to navigate that now, rather than feeling this emotion that feels uncomfortable, therefore going to use food or going to use my body or going to use exercise.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which then brings us to the next coping or a foundational skill, which is using my authentic voice. So when we're feeling all of those emotions, like we just said, like triggers and all of this, it's like, what do we do with that? And so what we need to do is we need to be able to ask for what we need. And so a lot of times people who struggle with eating issues have a hard time asking for what they need, because sometimes it could be fear. Sometimes it could be maybe they did when they were younger and they were, you know, rejected, you know, and so like they stopped asking, or they stopped, you know, creating boundaries. So like using my authentic voice is really about communicating your truth. So sometimes the other thing too is people who struggle with eating sometimes have a hard time with conflict, you know, like with disagreeing with someone, or like having a hard time with saying what they believe because of fear of not being liked, or, you know, something like that. And so that's what number eight is, being able to say what it is that you need. Being able to say what you need is sort of a way of saying that I'm going to be able to trust myself to take care of me when I need it. So that's like all of it. Like throughout this whole thing, like you mentioned in number one, it's like trust. Number eight is exactly that. And a lot of times we have fear. People who struggle with eating have fear and anxiety because, what if I don't know what to do in a situation? Then what? then that, and that's what, you know, stops them, or you start to feel stuck, because it's like that fear of the unknown, of the ambiguity, or of something that's not planned. What do I do with that if a situation happens like that? And so that's number eight. It's what you can do is you do what you need to do for yourself in your heart. Like, whether it be speaking up, whether it be whatever it is, but taking care of yourself and trusting yourself that you're going to be able to do that. So I'll give an example. I had a client tell me that she said, "Hey, Beth, you know, I want to date and I want to have these close relationships, but what if the person I date breaks my heart? Or what if, like, I have, like, best friends that betray me?" And then she goes, "How do I actually really trust them? You know, like, how do I trust someone to let them in my heart?" And what I said to her was, in time, you're going to learn, like, to trust others. But the person that you're really going to have to learn to trust is you. You're going to have to learn that if you're getting into a relationship, that when someone betrays you, that you can trust yourself, that you're going to take care of you by standing up for yourself, by saying what you need, by, you know, just sort of taking care of yourself and no longer abandoning yourself. So that's what happened. I found that the reason a lot of my clients were afraid to be in relationships was because they would abandon themselves when things got hard. What I mean by that is, if someone broke up with them, for example, they might, instead of speak compassionately to themselves and do self-care, they might be mean to themselves by saying, "See, you're not lovable." You know, like, all of the negative voices, all of that stuff where it's punishing themselves, where then now they're feeling defeated. And then they abandon themselves by not taking care of themselves anymore. They stay in bed all day, and then maybe they're not eating. Maybe they're not, like, doing the things that they need to be doing. Maybe they're doing things that are more harmful than good. So they've completely abandoned themselves. So there's no trust there. So that we kind of talk about it in that way, that what we do is, it's no guarantee that we can trust anyone 100%, but there's a guarantee that you can trust yourself 100%. If those are the things that you're doing for yourself, that no matter what, you're going to be able to take care of yourself if the relationship doesn't go the way you want it to go.
And I think that's a really interesting point, because I think we spoke about this a few weeks ago on the podcast in terms of things that, like, sexual trauma, in terms of, it's a lot easier to, you know, not easier, in terms of the fact that when someone's in that situation, it feels more manageable to say, "That was my fault.
Yes,
I was doing something wrong," rather than, "It was them that was the bad person," because then in the future it feels, I will have control over that. Because if I don't do that thing, let's say I was a bit drunk, okay, well, I'm not going to drink alcohol anymore, then it won't happen to me again. It's easier to blame the situation on yourself than it is to blame it on other people, because it you then feel more out of control. And I think that totally makes sense, doesn't it? If something awful happens to you, then it feels safer to blame yourself. And the other thing that I wanted to say about that was, I think a lot of the time, in terms of, like, in recovery, putting yourself first, a lot of people, I think, are, they always put others first, and they do that because they're people pleasers, or, you know, it feels uncomfortable to put yourself first. It feels selfish.
Yes.
And actually, my experience of this, because throughout recovery, I have started putting myself first and, you know, taking care of my needs, because at the end of the day, the only person that's going to make me the priority is myself.
Yes.
And so focusing on my needs, and, you know, sometimes I'll be out with friends and I'm like, actually, you know what? I'm tired now. I'm going to go home. And at the start, I was so worried that people would judge me for kind of leaning into my own needs and stuff like that. But honestly, the amount of respect I feel like I've gained because of it, and people have said, you know, "You're so authentic, you're so honest, it's so lovely to see the true you." And it feels really uncomfortable at the start, because if it's not something you've done before, you do feel really like, oh God, like, I don't like putting myself first, this feels so selfish. But actually, I think people really respect you, because they're kind of like, well, if you're honest with yourself and authentic, then I know that you're being honest and authentic with me, and then they feel they can trust you more because of that.
Totally, yes. Yes. And then it also helps you too, because then you know in any situation that you're going to be okay, because you're going to just need to say what you need to say. But if you have a hard time though saying what you need, then it's going to be like, I don't want to go do this thing.
Yeah.
Because I can't trust myself that I'm going to be able to say that I need to leave.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. And it's funny, actually, just going back to the festival on the weekend, I was like, I think I'm a bit tired now. I'm going to go back to bed. But it was the last night. And so I started walking and I was like, no, do you know what? I don't think I'm ready to go to bed yet. I want to keep dancing with my friends. So I went back out and danced for 2 more hours. And I was just like, that was so nice to be able to have that connection with myself and be like, am I ready?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. I'm going to go dance more. And I don't think that I would have been able to do that before. I think there would have been like, you know, oh, what if I'm tired tomorrow? Or maybe I wouldn't have left in the first place because I would have been worried what people would have thought. So it's really nice to be so in tune.
Totally.
And I think that's the thing about recovery as well, is that when you're in recovery, you think it's just going to be, I'm going to be at peace with my body and I'm going to be able to eat. And actually, it's your whole life that it translates to.
And I love that you did that, because it was, again, using your authentic voice in that you have a right to change your mind. Just because you said that doesn't mean you have to just do that. It's like, okay, you know what?
Yes.
I checked in and I got more clarity, and this is what I wanted to do instead.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I came back, everyone was like, I thought you went to bed. And I literally said that. I was like, a girl can change her mind. Thank you very much.
It's great. I love that. Yeah. So, number 8 is using my authentic voice. And then the last foundational skill is changing my story. Number 9, changing my story. So what that means is that a lot of times when people struggle with eating disorder, it becomes who they are. It's like, maybe they spent a lot of years struggling with their eating disorder. And a lot of times they have a story that says, I can't do that. I have an eating disorder. Or I can't do that because I could never do that. Or I'm never going to be okay with this. I can't try something new. It's like that old story. And so what changing my story means is like that at any point, whatever your narrative is, you can change it. And so like once they are able to understand that, like, even if you say to yourself, like, oh, I do this exercise, but it's so hard. Like sitting with these feelings are really hard. So I can change the story and say, you know what? It's not so hard. It just takes practice. You know, and so when we start changing in our mind, our story in that way, it helps the narrative change, shift in your mind that doesn't feel like you're stuck anymore. And so it really helps, because as you know, like with eating disorders, a lot of times our beliefs become rigid. And so the more we are able to be flexible with our story and we're able to change it, the easier it becomes for us to do that. And then it reflects on our behaviors as well. So our behaviors follow when we start to change our thoughts in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that. I think that that's so powerful in terms of, oh, I can't do that because I've got an eating disorder, or, you know, I couldn't do that because of this, that, and the other. Eating sort of puts a lot of limitations on you, and I think also makes you believe that you can't do things. And I also think with that, it's a lot of the time when people have been living with an eating disorder or any mental health condition, it also becomes your identity and your label.
Yes.
And being able to step away from that, it's kind of like, well, I want to do that because this is ruining my life, but also what's going to be left of me? And I think that was something that I kind of spoke about a couple of months ago, was I think a lot of people talk about the eating disorder being like a separate entity to yourself.
Yes.
And my kind of perception of it that's really helped me is thinking about it of the eating disorder isn't separate to me. It's made up of different parts of me. But now it's about fine tuning and refining it so that I keep those parts of me, similarly to what I was saying about the critical voice earlier. But they're not, I'm not using those parts negatively anymore. I'm using them positively.
Yes.
So I'm still Hannah.
Totally.
I'm still made up of the same parts. I have a lot more understanding and awareness now.
Yes.
And maybe more parts are coming in, but I also have lots of different identities. I'm not just Hannah with the eating disorder. I'm Hannah the friend, Hannah the partner, Hannah the daughter, Hannah the sister. Like, there's so much more to me than just the eating disorder. And that scared me the most was, like, you know, even though I don't like the eating disorder, it's a big part of me. Mm-hmm. But it's still okay for those parts to be me. It's just I don't want the eating disorder to be the only part of
right.
me.
Right, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, Beth, honestly, that was absolutely incredible. I loved exploring all of those parts with you. Sorry, my alarm's going off. And I loved exploring all of those parts with you. And I think every time that you said one, I was like, no, it can't get better than this. And then you said another and I was like, she has hit the nail so hard on the head here. So thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Where can people go to find out more about you, to find your book
okay.
and all the work
yes.
that you're doing?
So I do run an intensive outpatient program in on Oahu, and that's the Journey Therapy. And then I also have my website, Bethany C. Crowley. So it's my name, BethanyCCrowley.com. And then the book is just sold anywhere. So it's sold at Amazon. I think it's at Amazon UK for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's on Amazon, and it's, I don't know if you can see this, but it's an integrative approach to treating eating disorders.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'll pop a link in the podcast notes for people so that they can find that.
Yeah. And so this book is, it's written for therapists, but it's really okay for people who are struggling with eating disorders as well. I have so many clients that have purchased it and they are doing the exercises on their own and even working with me for sure. But also the ones that have their own therapist, they've been bringing it to their therapist and they've been working mm-hmm. on it together. But it's been
amazing.
Just really just great. I mean, for me, I feel like it's made my work so much easier when I meet a new client, because when they start reading the first chapter, just things go off for them. They just mm-hmm. are like, oh my gosh. And so they've been taking notes, and then they see me and we clarify and we kind of go through it together with what the part says. And then I learn so much about them just by their mm-hmm. questions, because to see what they relate to. And it's just made my work so much easier as far as like, talking about what we're going to be working on and the approach and all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds brilliant. And I think just every element is, like we were saying before, so equally important and kind of coexisting.
Yes.
And I'm sure as people work through one, it then builds on the other and really just paints that, mm-hmm. really strong picture for recovery. So thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to meet you and also to talk it through with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And feel free to contact me if you have any questions. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, have a lovely sleep.
Thank you. it's midnight here now. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Midnight. Yes. I thought it was 10.
Oh, it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to let you go then.
Okay. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Amazing.
All right.
Thanks so much,
Bye.
Beth. Speak to you soon. Thanks. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.